Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your host, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Back in the House of Mystery, and joining us for the interview, we have the author of the book Mothers and Murderers. Now, this is a true story of love, lies, obsession, and second chances. So with us is Catherine Ellison. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So this is quite the story. This is a true story for you. This is something that you have been through yourself. So this is coming from your own memoir in a way. So tell us how this all started.
Well, I was a cub reporter in 1981 when I got assigned to this trial, and the trial was a man who was a restaurant owner from Michigan, but the most charismatic person in the trial was his wife, who was not being charged. And I was just absolutely fascinated by her because she was a stay-at-home mother of three, casserole cooker, and yet there was something kind of sinister about her from the start. And I kind of got sucked into the story and then made a terrible mistake and for which I got sued by her for $11 million. And after that, our lives were kind of connected for years to come.
Wow. So now, you were reporting on her husband then, is that right?
I was. He was the one who was standing trial along with, he had hired two men to travel from Michigan to California and shoot his wife's former husband at his townhouse door in Santa Clara.
Wow. Now, why would he want to do that? Because it's the former husband.
Exactly. That was the big question around the trial, and that's one of the things that it created an air of mystery around his wife, because where was she? Why didn't she have the motive? And the prosecutor just didn't have any evidence against her, but he did have evidence against the husband, so he tried as hard as he could to concoct a theory that the husband would gain financially from this murder.
Wow. And so now, what happened in that trial? So did the husband get convicted then?
Well, in the first trial, that argument about the motive just fell flat, and the jury hung on the businessman, but convicted the triggerman, because the triggerman actually confessed. But then there was a second trial, and he was sentenced to life without parole for the murder. But she was not charged. And my mistake was to, I wrote a story about the prosecutor's final argument, which had a lot of the wife in it. Her name was Judy Singer. And he just mentioned her name so many times that something didn't click. And I wrote that Judy and Bob Singer had conspired to kill the victim, which wasn't what she had not been charged with that.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Oh, dear is right.
Well,
Yeah.
And, you know, I understand it. You know, both of us do. We both write and do radio and podcast and that. So it's very easy to kind of just say something and not, you know, it's something that seems obvious, you know. And
yeah, but it was really like, you know, I mean, thinking back on it, and I was in my 20s then and not very experienced, but it was really like a surgeon committing malpractice, you know, leaving a scalpel inside a patient or operating on the wrong organ. I mean, you're not supposed to do it, or the copy editor should have caught it. It was a terrible thing at the time, but without giving away too much of the plot, because there's lots of crazy twists and turns. The wife was convicted of the murder 14 years later.
Oh. Well,
I was
okay.
Right, I was still wrong.
Yeah.
The prosecutor never argued. I said he argued.
If you could have had a time machine, you might have been
right.
Correct.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, or if you had, you know, lots of money to draw it out. So when you reported that original story, she caught it and she got a lawyer and actually sued you then?
Yes. 2 weeks, well, first she complained and we ran the correction. And then 2 weeks later, I'm sitting in the press room and the lawyer, who was her husband's lawyer in the trial, who, you know, we'd been great friends, he'd given me all sorts of outrageous quotes, he comes in and he apologized and he handed me the summons to the civil suit.
Wow. And so what happened to you at that time? Like, did the paper you were working for fire you? Did they stand behind you? How did that go?
Well, neither, actually. I had been making a lot of mistakes up until that time. I was very energetic and very dramatic writer, and they loved me for that, and I had a lot of front page stories. But I also just kept screwing up in mostly minor ways. It was almost like a self-sabotaging kind of a thing that's not uncommon, I guess, for some young women. And, you know, I mean, it was a time when women were just really breaking into journalism and some of the good jobs in journalism, and it was really heady. I mean, I'd been educated to think I could do anything I wanted, but who knows what psychological forces were at play, but I was really undermining myself. So at that point, they were quite nervous about keeping me on staff, so they suspended me for 3 days. And my managing editor, to whom I'll always be grateful, said, "You really ought to get some help." So I did, and in a very strong way, I'm very grateful to Judy Singer for kind of pushing me into that position, because I don't think I ever would have looked at myself with the care that I needed to kind of get on a better path.
So you actually considered it to be an issue yourself, like about yourself, not so much just being energetic go-getter of a reporter. I mean, because I say that because personally I think we've all been at the go-getter stage, and it's just you know, if you survive it as you get older, you're not quite so go-getter. It's more like just get. Yeah, it's like get, but not go-get. But so I mean, how do you determine the difference between what's just being over anxious and pre-publishing things before you have, you know, maybe the proper credentials or timing, as compared to when
Ellen,
you say,
it's really generous. It's really generous of you to frame this as pre-publishing. But what I did was it was by any viewpoint a mistake.
Right.
The prosecutor, he came close to saying that the two of them conspired, but he did not say it. So when I said that Judy and Robert Singer plotted the murder, that was just plain careless. And if I'd have been more professional at the time, I would have sat down there and just looked at every word and made sure it was true. And I definitely got into that habit afterwards. But I had sort of an overconfidence, or who knows? I mean, I think the unconscious is pretty fascinating. And in in that instance, I think it was a combination of really, you know, really suspecting that she had more to do with the crime than was being presented, plus some kind of crazy urge to self-destruct ended up with this mistake.
What year was this exactly?
It was 1981.
Oh, well. I mean, I say that because, could you imagine, okay, right now, 2020, there's so much unchecked and unfiltered news all over the internet and all these groups doing all sorts of, you know, they're the...
Absolutely.
And think about how much, and what you're doing, in my mind, is... If you were at the trial or we were watching the trial, we would probably be going, well, you know, we know they're in it together. She knew about it, obviously, right? You'd be thinking because it's her ex-husband. So there's like that would just be what people were saying. So what you reported is just what people were thinking. And that, of course, is a no-no on a legitimate news service because you're not allowed to do that. But...
Right, and you make a really good point that news services, unfortunately, a lot of them are getting less and less legitimate, and we're seeing more stuff on the internet that isn't checked. And I was incredibly lucky. I feel really privileged to have worked in newspapers during their heyday, you know, before they were all broken up and sold and so many people were laid off, because it was an incredible practice, a discipline to become a more careful, accurate, and better writer, you know, writing under pressure. So it was amazing training. I'm really grateful for it.
Yeah. Oh, and going out and learning to get sources and actually getting information direct and all that. It's quite a talent. It's quite an art to that type of reporting. So, but now even after all of this, did you end up? How long did the court process take with this libel suit?
Luckily, it was just about 2-3 years before she stopped pursuing it. At first, they pursued it very aggressively, and I think that they actually thought that they could make a lot of money with it. Our lawyer argued that, you know, he showed the prosecutor's words. He showed that, you know, he had almost said what I wrote, and you know, they filed a lot of motions, and we combated them, and then she just stopped pursuing it. And a couple of things had happened by then. One, she was arrested for shoplifting, and then one of the most amazing things about this story is it was revealed through a long, crazy process that she had been sleeping with the attorney for her husband during the trial. So this is the big... The lawyer's secretary found a bunch of love letters from her in his desk, and sent them, because she hated him, she sent them all over the place, including to us. And so at that point, Judy's reputation was no longer worth $11 million, and I think she just stopped pursuing it because of that. So the judge dismissed it, and it was no longer a problem. But during that time, this is another kind of interesting thing. Not only was I trying to figure out why I'd made those mistakes in psychotherapy, but I was also trying to regain my editor's trust. So I, as a freelancer, I went to Africa and Central America, and I'd always wanted to be a foreign correspondent, so I wanted to show them that I was a serious contender. And a lot of great things happened in the process, including that I met my husband. So again, it's just amazing how things that you think are the worst thing that could ever happen to you sometimes turn out to be the best.
Yeah. Now, was that the same lawyer that actually served you?
Yes. His name was Bill Melcher, and may he rest in peace. Because he passed away from cancer a few years ago, but he was quite a character. There was a special hearing to determine, you know, because once these letters came out, as you can imagine, Judy's husband was quite upset with her, and he volunteered to give evidence against her. But before that happened, they had to have a trial to see, you know, if she really had slept with his lawyer. You know, they had to have a special hearing to determine that. And that went on for weeks and weeks. And they had all sorts of evidence, you know, all sorts of evidence that this affair had happened. And Bill Melcher, the lawyer, actually tried to defend against it by claiming that he was impotent ever since he had a vasectomy, and he couldn't have slept with her, and he even put his wife on the stand to argue on his behalf. But in the end, the lawyers for, I hope this isn't too complicated to follow, but the lawyers for Bob Singer came on and said that they had medical records that he'd been treated for venereal diseases after his vasectomy. So, it was quite an amazing hearing. Yeah.
My. Boy, that sounds pretty fun.
It was fun to read about, because at that point I was kind of unhappy with them that they had sought to make so much money. I mean, I recognized that I made a mistake, but I thought that they had been, you know, kind of greedy to try to take advantage of it.
Well, yeah, $11 million's crazy. And what what paper was it for? Was it like, it's not like the New York Times, a national paper, right?
Well, so it was the San Jose Mercury, which was, you know, it was a fairly much paper in California. So
yeah,
and it had a wire service with Knight Ridder newspapers.
So now, so you pulled yourself out of that kind of what do you call hole that you kind of got into there? How long did that take? How long does it take to get out of something like that, where your editor started trusting you again and people started taking your reports?
Yeah, well, it was great, because they did stand by me in the sense that they kept me on the trial, you know, which was agony in a way, because, you know, all the other court reporters knew that I'd been sued and I felt so embarrassed about it. But I had to just keep showing up and just, you know, trying to be more and more professional. And so that was kind of a trial by fire. And then I did this foreign reporting that they really appreciated. So the suit was in 1981. And by 1987, they hired me to be the Mexico City Bureau for the paper, so the bureau chief. So I guess it took, actually, in 1984, they assigned me to kind of a high-level series of an investigation of corruption in the, so that was a great sign of trust. And that series actually won a prize for that.
Well, good. I mean, now, did you ever come to terms or figure out exactly why, or you might say understand why you think you made that mistake, as you call it?
Well, you know, I couldn't give you a clear answer, but I think that there was an element of, it was scary to be, I'd kind of risen really quickly as a journalist, and to the point where when I made that mistake, they were actually thinking of sending me to Mexico much sooner. And it was all really heady. And so there's something there, I think, and there's something there about just the atmosphere in the courtroom that Judy was getting away with it, that it was really her idea, that she was much smarter than her husband. So there was a little bit of that, too. But one of the more interesting things was that Judy was a lot, in some very exterior ways, like my mother, who was also a stay-at-home mom, kind of had a cult around her children, great casserole baker, fastidious dresser. I mean, they had all these things in common. And my mother was, I was very close to my mother, and my mother was in a situation where she was in a way a victim of my father. My father was, could be very cruel. And so we felt very guilty and very protective of her. So I could never show any anger towards my mother. So one theory I have is that, you know, I turned this anger that I couldn't turn on my mother towards this woman. But that's getting very psychological, and who knows if that was really the reason. But it felt right at the time.
Yeah. Now, how did you feel, like, in 1981, how was it being a woman also in that position? Was this something fairly new to the business?
Yeah, in that position as a court reporter, I mean, there weren't, most of our editors were men. Most of the reporters with really good jobs were men. And so here was this wave of women who'd come through school, been educated during the 70s when we had all this progress in women's education, and people were telling us we could do anything. And then we kind of hit up against the early 80s into the mid-80s was the beginning of this backlash against feminism. And there were, I don't know if you heard of Susan Faludi's great book, which is called Backlash, where she kind of traces what's happening in the culture. There was that famous article in Newsweek that said that, you know, women who wait till their 40s to find a husband have the same chance of finding a husband as being killed by a terrorist. And there were all these stories about women who regretted having careers. And so all that was kind of coming into the culture. And, you know, it's quite possible that.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Played a part in my being ambivalent about going for this big career. Like, you know, would I also find a man who would marry me? You know, if I was that into my career, because it was a generation in which so many women were leaving homes in which the mother was the homemaker, and you had these traditional marriages, and so we were, you know, the boomer generation was kind of cutting that cord, or, you know, really distancing ourselves from our mothers at the time.
And you know, first they were burning their bras, and then Madonna was out playing with herself on.
I just heard the other day that the bra burning never happened, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That was a kind of an urban myth, that there were no bras ever actually burned, but yeah, it was like when you look back at the 70s, it's just amazing how many important things happened, how much progress there was for feminism then, and then there was this huge retreat after Reagan was elected, and we start talking about these quote unquote family values again.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty amazing, you know, living through it long enough now to see the big advancements in women's rights or gay rights, all these things, and all of a sudden there's like a 10-year pullback, and then it goes forward again, and then everybody's happy, and then it goes back again. It seems like we keep going through these cycles.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's been net progress when you look at what happened with our Congress, for instance, how many women were elected.
Right.
Things are kind of, you know, I mean, they are moving forward. There's so many women in professions now, so many women doctors and lawyers and in graduate schools. So net, we're moving forward, but there definitely was a drawback in the 80s where all of a sudden, if you're out there trying to have a big career, there were reasons, more reasons to be doubting and questioning and worried.
Yeah. Well, I doubt myself every second day, so.
And it's not because you're a guy.
No.
I doubt him even more than that.
Yeah. Every time we talk. So is that kind of what, is that why you wrote the book? What was behind you actually getting in and writing and publishing a book?
Well, I have to tell you that this book haunted me for more than 30 years. And that's, you know, it's almost a story in itself. I started writing books. My first book was about Imelda Marcos. And then I got a contract to write this murder story because after she was arrested in 1991, it seemed as if, oh, here's the resolution of this crazy case that had so much. I mean, there's just so many outrageous parts of it when you start really looking into it. So I easily sold the proposal to Simon & Schuster, got a big advance, started going, you know, took a leave from my job, went all over the country, and wrote this book. But I promised the prosecutor I wouldn't publish or wouldn't send it to my publisher until she went to trial. And that she just delayed things till like 1995, practically. And so by that time, I had a new editor at Simon & Schuster, and I didn't write the book very well, I think because I had so many psychological issues with it that I hadn't really understood. And they canceled the contract, which is the only time that's ever happened to me. I mean, I went on to write 9 more books, and it never happened. But this one, it was like the one that got away. So
yeah.
Things kind of slowed down last year, and I had time on my hands, and I went back to it, and I wrote it sort of with a fresh perspective, and finally got it sold.
Yeah, wow. Well, that's so. Your relationship with his Judy Singer kind of has gone on this whole time.
Yeah. It's definitely stopped since her parole hearing. She was released in October, like just a couple weeks after the book came out. Her sentence had been commuted, so it was no longer life without parole. And then she went up, for parole hearing, and they voted to let her out. So after more than 25 years in prison, she walked out in October. But I was at the parole hearing, and she and I had corresponded. We talked on the phone. I'd interviewed her at length back in, you know, in the early 1990s when I had the contract. And we were always pretty friendly, even after she, you know, she'd sued me. We established kind of an interesting, friendly relationship. But by the time I showed up at the parole hearing, she decided that I was against her, and she tried to get me not to be able to attend. So she wasn't successful, and that was really interesting to see her at that hearing. So I'm glad I was able to go. But since then, I really haven't heard from her.
Oh, yeah, well, probably not. So what can you talk about, like, what exactly it was that got her convicted? Like, what mistake did she make?
Well, the mistake she made was, I think, to sleep with the lawyer. You know,
well.
Talk about Talk about self-destructive. Her husband was going to go to prison and protect her forever. He was so in love with her and so devoted to the three children that she'd had from this former marriage that it was quite pathetic. And so he was going to keep their secret forever. But then he read these letters, and he was mocked at by the prison guards, and he just couldn't stand it anymore and became a witness for the prosecution. And they, you know, he wasn't a great witness, but he offered some evidence, and then there were, his son had been visiting them at one point and overheard her yelling at him about it. And apparently it was all her idea, and she had goaded him into it.
Wow. Just going back, you wrote the Marcos book. Did she really have hundreds of pairs of shoes?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Oh. I just had to know. It's something I
They're
used to
in a museum now.
That's what I...
Really?
Yeah, 500 black bras. Yeah, this is another interesting strong woman character.
Wow.
Another woman. I think there's kind of a theme there because this was somebody else who kind of styled herself like Judy as, you know, this doting mother and a wonderful wife, whereas behind the scenes she was a kind of a schemer and a manipulator.
Wow. It's just amazing. So at the end of the day, what do you want people to come away with when they read your book?
That's a good question. I think I think this book, I mean, it's fun. I've heard that it's a really fun read, so I'd want people to enjoy it and spread it around. But as far as a message, I think that there's a very strong message about the power of self-awareness. I was so lucky that I was sort of forced to become more self-aware. And for all those years, I was watching Judy kind of suffer the consequences of not being self-aware. She was somebody who was incredibly obtuse about her own motives, and I think she actually believed some of the lies that she told herself about herself. So she and I had both suffered some child abuse, and I saw the effects of that with her and with me, and the advantages I had of really being able to process it and come out of it versus, I think she was pretty much trapped in a cycle. And one of the consequences of that was, that's one of the most tragic parts of the book, was that she was abusive with her own daughter, who really turned against her in the end. And I think that it wasn't even conscious on her part. She was just repeating what she'd learned. So I really felt pretty sorry for her, but I also felt like it was just a huge advantage to be able to get the opportunity to have my face stuck in my own, you know, issues. I was reading the other day, James Hollis asked this, he says that the question nobody can answer is, of what are you unconscious, you know? And it's just a wonderful opportunity to be able to kind of think about what are you unconscious of, you know, what motives are you following that you're not even aware of.
Well, I live my life that way. Unconscious. It's just better that way. Not as much pain. If I wake up, it's a bad day.
I know, denial. It's a wonderful thing.
it's better to go back in denial. You know, have a coffee and forget it. I don't know. Wow. So now this book is a lot more than just this is only one little part of it. So this book is actually kind of a memoir as well. You've incorporated a lot of your experience and through life and the journey you took. So it's more than just about this murder case and Judy Singer.
Yeah, I like to think of it as a mashup between Fargo and Eat, Pray, Love and Body Heat. It's kind of got elements of all of them.
Oh, there you go. See?
When we were working on the subtitle, you know, it's like, okay, so it's love, lies, obsession, and second chances. Wait, can I put something else in there?
Yeah. Like Fargo. Actually, you see, Mike's Canadian. He can talk like Fargo.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My brain speaks to me in Fargoese.
Well, the Fargo part was the people that the two men that the restaurant owner hired to kill his wife's former husband were the most amazing bumblers that you've ever. I mean, if it weren't so tragic, it would be really funny. He hired his own busboy, which was kind of dumb to begin with, and then the busboy and the trigger man drove from Flint, Michigan to Santa Clara, California. They got lost. They ended up in a ditch. They forgot ammunition. You know? I mean, they just were the most unprofessional hitmen you could imagine. That's where it gets like Fargo, I think.
That's crazy, too. I mean, how do you just come out and ask people if they want to kill someone?
Yeah, I know.
Like, I could never just figure that out, just in a restaurant. Hey, you want to go kill someone for me? Okay, yeah.
You know. Craigslist, I guess.
Yeah, the restaurant owner was absolutely desperate. There was testimony that he went with his manager. He got his manager to go with him to a nightclub to try to look for hitmen. You know? Okay. The manager had no idea. What?
Hey, Mike, let's go to the nightclub and hire someone.
Yeah, I know.
No, I'll just go dance.
Yeah, it's crazy. Oh, let's find a hitman in the disco. I don't know. Yeah, I just, you have to wonder, you know. But so what are your influences in writing? Do you have other people writers that have influenced you, narrative, or is there some sort of style you like best?
I love reading. I mean, it's just one thing that I most love to do, and the writers that I like are just almost too numerous to mention. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I was going for a certain style, but it's interesting that there is a whole mini genre of murder memoirs now, which I just think is so fascinating, because anytime that somebody picks on writing about, you know, a true crime story, you've got to know that there's something that resonates with them psychologically. So to put that out there, I find it really interesting. So The Fact of a Body is a book like that, which is just great, about a woman who's a lawyer who investigates a case of where the suspect was, you know, a child abuser, and she had suffered some child abuse, you know, in her growing up. And so it's just an interesting thing. As a court reporter, I thought it was such a luxury to, you know, if you're a voyeur at all, because when you read court transcripts, they're just the most personal look. You know, it's like, you know, you say most people are in some kind of denial, but when you read arrest records, it's like you're peeling away all these layers and just really looking at life as it is.
Hmm. That's kind of like how society is now, don't you think? It's so obsessed with true crime right now.
True crime is definitely, I can't believe how popular it is. It's really surprising. And it went down. It was having kind of a moment when I got my contract from Simon & Schuster back in 1991, and then it plunged. And now it's like, I can't believe how many venues there are, podcasts and, you know, radio shows and books. Incredible.
Yeah, it's crazy. People are really into killing, I guess.
Oh, boy.
Well, I think I think it's that people just want to know that other people are as flawed as they are, I think. So when you read these true crime stories, you're not looking at the Facebook curated image.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you got planned next after this book here? Are you planning to continue in this type of writing or do something different?
I'm really not sure. I've written three books on ADHD, which is a big interest of mine, and I'm still following that. And I've written a book on the environment, and I'm still following that. Right now, I'm just spending a lot of time, you know, promoting the book and writing stories based on the book and speaking about it. But I've also been doing a number of articles about psychology and psychotherapy, which is kind of something that originated from the book, and I'm really enjoying that. I've been writing for an online magazine called Knowable, about psychotherapy and the research into it.
So psychotherapy is really important, don't you think? It's something that I think probably most people need.
Yeah, definitely. And the research I did for this article, it's quite amazing how the people who've been doing psychotherapy the number has really declined, while the number of people who just get prescribed antidepressants from their general practitioner has climbed. I mean, if you look at a graph showing these two trends, it's amazing. And part of the reason is that insurance plans are no longer paying as much for talk therapy, even though we're supposed to have parity with mental health and physical health. So it's just not easy to get talk therapy. I feel, again, like I was incredibly lucky to be needing it and getting it at the time that happened. It's much harder to find a person now. Yeah,
and it just seems like it I think it just got easier to give pills out to people, and I don't know, it seemed to go that way for a while.
The trend is still going on. I mean, it's still increasing, and it's quite sad because pills don't cure you. You know, I mean, the pills work on symptoms, but I really think it's worthwhile for people to understand themselves better. I mean, we have a lot of people in the White House who could probably benefit from that. And
yeah, the whole place.
It's not happening.
just all of them. Just do the whole thing. Group session.
Yeah. Democrats, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, just group session for everyone. You know, hold hands and sing. I've given up. It's not going to happen.
No.
So now you have a website that people can go to if they want to find out about you, your books, and...
I do.
Okay.
www.katherineellison.com. I also have a Facebook page. If you're interested especially in anything about ADHD, I keep current on that. That's kind of an important issue.
Well, yeah, for sure. It's something we all need to be aware of, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so now the book is out. It's available through Wild Blue Press and Amazon and all good bookstores.
Yeah,
we'll have it on our website as well. So people that listen to the interview can just do one click and pick up the book.
Thank you so much.
It's been great. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you. And the book we're talking about is Mothers and Murderers, and the guest has been the author and true crime journalist, we'll say, Katherine Ellison. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Alan. It really was fun. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Katherine.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.